that mothers tend to be more powerful, nurturing figures. Fathers tend to exert more control over their kids' behaviors. Mothers tend to encourage caution, where fathers are more challenging of achievement and independence. Now, it's on this last point that I got into the biggest argument with my wife I ever had. I was, back in like 1995, the international headquarters of the National Fatherhood Initiative was in a room off my bedroom. So, I was home when my kids came home, and one day my oldest daughter came home and she said, you know, I got to go to the store to get some school supplies. And I said, well, I'm busy right now. We'll have to wait a little bit. She goes, no, you don't understand. It's a really big project, and it's due tomorrow. Now, I know you've never had a child that had to put anything off. But I'm a psychologist. We're into self-confessional behavior. So I will confess that sometimes my kids put things off. And still I said, I insisted, no, I'm really busy. You'll have to wait. She said, Dad, I got to do it. I got to go to the store. And then I came up with, she was in sixth grade, came up with this brilliant idea. I said, well, you know, it's not that far. It's about a mile and a half. Why don't you walk? And she looked at me in stunned horror, and she said, but, Dad, you know that intersection? And now, the intersection, my wife, I call a rather busy intersection. My wife calls it the crossroads of death. You know, there's like six rows that come, and it's multiple lines. And to get to the store, she has to cross that. So, you know, I'm not an idiot. I talked to her about how to get there, what to do, what to look for, and I sent her on her way. So, and she got the stuff. She came home. She was. I made one mistake. What was the mistake? I didn't say, don't tell your mother. So sure enough, you know, my wife came back from that really important job she has, and she walks in the door, and I hear my daughter go, guess what Daddy let me do today? And so my wife, she's a calm, thoughtful woman, so she disappeared for a few minutes and came, threw the divorce papers on the table. So they asked me if I had lost my mind. But the reality is that what children, it's not that I was right and she was wrong. I was right because she didn't die. Yeah, that's like the father's, outcome-based measurement. Hey, nobody died. Moms have like a different standard. But it's that what kids need is they need both. They need to grow up well. It's not that they should be foolish risk takers, but they should calculate risk. Not be afraid of risk. You know, if it's up to my wife, you know, my daughter would be 25, and then she could go to the store on her own. But on the other hand, you don't want foolish risk takers. But if you have one side of the parenting equation encouraging risk and achievement, the other encouraging caution, then what you get is you get a nice combination that results in children who take calculated risks. Now, it's also through a boy's observation of the way his father treats the boy's mother that he learns how to treat women. The father treats his mother with respect and dignity. Their sons generally grow up to treat women in the same way. If they treat the mom with disdain and cruelty, unfortunately, they also tend to grow up and treat women that way as well. And then fathers are important in helping children transition to the adult world. This is especially critical for boys. Robert Putnam wrote a noted psychiatrist wrote a book called Man Enough, in which he describes that throughout most of human history, that for boys to transition to manhood, there's usually some kind of ritual or ceremony that helps boys make that transition. And that ritual or ceremony is often organized by the community of fathers. And that if through that ritual or ceremony, the boy develops the sense that I am now no longer in the company of children, but in the company of men. And I must now act like a man. If there isn't that kind of ritual or that kind of transitional help, then boys search for that affirmation that they are man enough in other ways, often through the accumulation of sexual conquests, the accumulation of wealth, or the accumulation of power. Now, one way to highlight the importance of fathers within the broader culture is through the use of mass media public awareness campaigns. And when I was at the National Fatherhood Initiative back in 1996. We developed a series of public service announcements which played on radio, TV, and print. I brought a couple of those today to kind of show some examples of what we did in the United States. So now, I'm going to take no credit for the creativity of this, because it was done by a team of really, really creative advertisers. And this is the first one that was developed.
The male emperor of Penguin at Antarctica balances his unborn offspring on his feet for weeks in sub-zero temperatures. Then, after it hatches, he provides shelter for the chick in a fold of skin and feathers. If the father is unwilling or unable to do this, the chick will not survive. Just a reminder how important it is for fathers to spend time with their children.
Now, when they showed me this, I was just blown away. Because, you know, it looks like you're watching Discovery or Nature Channel or something, right? There's one wonderful little sort of, you know, but, and remember again the context. Back in 1996, it was only a year before that the American Psychological Association Republican artists said, fathers don't matter. There's no evidence that fathers matter. So with this ad, you don't know what you're watching. You just think it's the animal kingdom. Penguins, cute. And at the very end, it just has this wonderful little tag that says, just a reminder that we're not talking about penguins. Then we did the next one.
One of the reasons why I'm poor is the one threatening national hills of Father Rise, still able to young. Here, the lion cub gets a lesson in proper worship for his father. Teaching his behavior is not just crucial to the pride, but also the survival of the species. Just a reminder how important it is for fathers to spend time with their children.
Just not only for the, but for the survival of the species. Could you imagine if we had done this with human people first? Nobody would have played it. And yet these ads have won awards all over the place. Women particularly love these ads. I mean, it's just terrific. Then we thought we would push a little bit more in the next ad.
When young bull elephants from a national park in South Africa were moved to different locations without the presence of an adult male, they began to wantonly kill other animals. When an adult male was relocated with them, the delinquent behavior stopped. Without the influence of their dad, kids are more likely to get in trouble too. Just a reminder how important it is for fathers to spend time with their children.
Again, you know, the sort of, it's what we call the Rod Serling ending, you know, Twilight Zone ending. We also wanted to do some with some humor, and so the next one. This original script had husband to Jane, and was going to be our subtle sort of introduction of marriage into these ads, and the stations wouldn't play it, which is interesting. So we had to sort of cut that out. We also wanted to, we'll do this one here too. And then this next one showed up in my mailbox. We didn't produce it, it just showed up.
Thank you.
So as we went along, we got a little bit more adventurous. We also, in the last one I'll show you, we also wanted to make it clear to men that we're not just talking about their relationship with their sons, but also with their daughters. And this is the last one I'll show. Now, there are some people who say, well, what does, public service announcements do? What do you really get from them? Well, to date, and they still are airing additional ads since I left, over $500 million in donated airtime has been dedicated to these ads. It's generated almost 300,000 phone calls to a toll-free number, both from individuals and organizations. In a national tracking poll conducted by Millard Brown, agreement with the statement, having a father involved in a child's life is crucial to his or her well-being, grew in a national sample among African Americans from 70% to 90%. And agreement for women grew from 80% to 89%. So these ads really did make an impact and continue to make an impact on the broader culture. In fact, you don't really hear a lot of people insisting that you don't use the word father anymore in the United States. In fact, President Obama has a fatherhood initiative. You'd think if he was in the throes of the early 1990s culture, he would have called it a parenting initiative. But we have recaptured the idea, and that was what NFI, the idea of fatherhood, that's what NFI was all about. Now, that's fatherhood, that's nice. But it seems to me the third thing that one needs to do is recapture the idea that when all things being equal and everything is not always equal, married fatherhood offers certain advantages compared to unmarried fatherhood. And this was the much harder part. Now, I will confess that I am a culturalist at heart. I believe that culture trumps public policy when it comes to how we actually influence our behavior. When Brian talked about Britney Spears as a role model for our young, it was both humorous and unfortunately true. Culture trumps public policy. But that doesn't mean public policy is irrelevant. Because what public policy does is it sends signals to the broader culture about what it is that we as a people value and care about. If we're afraid to even use the word marriage in public policy, it sends the signal that there's something not quite right about marriage. And so, as a recovering government official, I value the importance of public policy, but largely, in terms of the signaling effects it sends to the broader culture. So what should public policy do when it comes to strengthening marriage in particular? Well, I like to begin by saying what I think government ought not to do. First of all, government ought not, in my view, to stigmatize children living in single-parent households. I know of no research that would suggest that stigmatizing a child because of the circumstances of their birth or health living arrangement is helpful to that child. It ought not to promote government, in my view, marriage by withdrawing supports for single-parent families for the reasons that I talked about earlier. It also ought not to intentionally or otherwise force anyone to get married or trap anyone in an abusive relationship. And it ought not to be afraid to promote and support marriage by being afraid to mention its name. And this was my quest for 6 years in government. It was to get government to use the word marriage again. I mean, when I started in 2001, you said marriage, people took out the cross, get away from me. It was, you just wouldn't use that word. So I'm a psychologist, and there's something in psychology called systematic desensitization. If you're terrified of something, you know, the more you're exposed to it, if nothing bad happens, the less you're fearful of it. Well, I became a one-man systematic desensitization effort with the word marriage in government. Everywhere I went, I talked about marriage, and I used the word. And eventually people got over their fear of it, and they started to actually start to think about it differently. I remember once when I went to graduate school, it was in the 1970s, and psychology was insane in the 1970s, and they taught, you know, a whole generation of child psychologists stuff that is just not true. And one of those is that you should never tell your children what to do. That they should discover for themselves, you know, what the right thing is to do. So I remember once almost 4-year-old daughter, I was trying to help her discover that it would be a good thing to pick up her toys. And she was getting, you know, more and more frustrated. And finally, she put her hands on her hips. She said, "Daddy, if you want me to do something, just tell me and I'll do it." So if we want people to, you know, if we think marriage is a good thing, if we think it's a public good, why are we afraid to say it? If we think that marriage and nurse, you know, comes with a certain benefits for children, why are we afraid to tell people it's better to be married than not to be married? Instead of maybe discovering it for themselves, or worse, by avoiding the word, giving the message there's something wrong with marriage. So what should government do? First, it should have as its goal promoting healthy marriages. Not just any kind of marriage. Dysfunctional, abusive marriages are not good for kids, and they're not good for the people in them. So it should be clear that this is about healthy marriage, not just marriage. Secondly, it should not merely strive to achieve neutrality when it comes to marriage. You know, government is neutral about lots of things. One of the things it's neutral about is what ice cream flavor you prefer. You know, used to get those ice cream boxes with vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. At least in my house when I was growing up, nobody liked strawberry. And so it was like you'd have that one little sliver of strawberry down the side, and the rest would be gone. And it was a nice excuse for my parents never to buy ice creams. They'd say, "There's ice cream in the freezer. Go eat the strawberry." Now, I bring that up because, you know, I mean, if you think that the flavor of ice cream is really important to the public good, we would have subsidies for eating strawberry ice cream. We'd have incentives the more people eat strawberry because it's being an underutilized sort of a commodity. But there's obviously no rationale for, you know, government being involved in that choice. But government is not neutral about lots of things. It's not neutral about home ownership, for example, or charitable giving. Precisely because it can be shown that home ownership and charitable giving contribute to public good. Communities with higher levels of home ownership are more stable, there's less crime, there's less dysfunction, and when people are encouraged to give charitable giving, you know, that's better for society as well. Now, we don't put a gun to people's heads and say you have to own a home or you have to give to charities, but we provide incentives through the tax code, at least in the U.S. I assume it's true here in Canada as well. And so government is not neutral about those things. So why, if we can show that marriage contributes to the public good, should we strive only to achieve neutrality? It seems to me that government should be on the side of healthy marriages, not simply neutral about the institution of marriage. And while we don't know as much as we'd like to know about promoting healthy marriages, we do know some things. We know, for example, that couples, what separates dysfunctional couples from healthy couples in marriage is not the frequency of conflict, which gives me a lot of, having been married for 35 years, I'm glad to hear that research, but rather how it is that one deals with conflict. We also know that marriage education programs can increase marital couples' happiness and long-term stability. And even that outreach to couples in difficult marriages, troubled marriages, can be saved. So we do know something. So it was armed with this perspective and this research that we started the Healthy Marriage Initiative in the United States back in 2006. That's when the United States Congress passed a bill appropriating $500 million over 5 years to provide supports in 3 major areas. The first was what something we call building strong families. This was based on research that said at the time a child is born out of wedlock, most of those parents, though unmarried, are in an exclusive romantic relationship with each other, and most are even contemplating marriage. And yet, what do we generally say to those couples when it comes to public policy? What's the one thing we tell them to do? We certainly don't tell them to get married, or to even contemplate getting married. What do we tell them? Get child support order in place and pay child support. Now, I'm not against child support, but it seems to me that that's not where most of those couples are. They're thinking about getting married, and you tell them, you need a child support order. So the idea was, what if we actually had a different intervention with those couples? And at that point that the child is born out of wedlock, we actually have people go in and say, hey, voluntary program, if you don't want it, no big deal. Here's a brochure. It's a healthy marriage program. If you're contemplating marriage, it might be a good idea for you to sort of enter into it, learn about marriage, the virtues of marriage, and also to think through the decision-making process. And so we gave a number of grants to organizations to do that. We also had the second priority area was supporting healthy marriages, where we provided marriage education to low-income couples who are already married. At least in the U.S., the myth is marriage has disappeared in low-income communities. Not true. There's lots of married couples. They just don't stay married for very long. And so what we try to do is say, well, what if we intervene with the already married low-income couples to help strengthen their marriages so that they can have those marriages stay stable and long-term? And then finally, something called community healthy marriage initiatives, where we would infuse into a community, which could be as defined as small as a block to as large as a city, a variety of different kinds of programs that would support marriage. Now, there are some, maybe even some in this room, who think, now, is this really a function of government? I mean, Wade, you're supposed to be a limited government guy. You know, is this a bridge too far for government? Why should government be involved in this? Well, here's my answer. To the extent that we are successful in promoting healthy marriages, we will be successful in preventing many of the social ills that impede the healthy development of children, of families, and indeed nations. As Derek said, I oversaw 65 different social programs in the federal government at a cost of about $47 billion a year. Go down the list. Child welfare. Programs for runaway and homeless youth, anti-poverty programs. Each of these programs is either created or exacerbated by family dysfunction and breakdown. Now, if we're going to prevent the need for those services, we're going to have to do something about whatever it is causing those things. Now, one way to accomplish that prevention, not the only way, but one way, is through programs and public policy that helps couples form and sustain healthy marriages. In fact, a compassionate society isn't content just to make sure that we have a child welfare system that takes care of abused, neglected children. But a compassionate society is one that tries to reduce the incidence of abuse and neglect in the first place because more children are growing up in healthy and stable households. A compassionate society isn't content just to have a wonderful network of runaway and homeless youth programs or centers. But a compassionate society tries to reduce the number of kids who feel the need to run away from home in the first place because they're living in a household with parents, with a mom and a dad that nurture and support each other and them. A compassionate society isn't content to run an effective mentoring program for kids whose parents are in prison. It also wants to try to reduce the number of kids who need a mentoring program because fewer guys are in prison in the first place because they're instead in healthy households and marriages that keep them out of trouble, as Brian had talked about earlier. And a compassionate society isn't content just to run an effective child support enforcement agency, but also to reduce the need for child support in the first place because fewer kids are living in broken homes. But you don't have to take my word for it. Let me read from somebody else. This author wrote, "Children living with single mothers are 5 times more likely to be poor than children in two-parent households. Children in single-parent households are also more likely to drop out of school and become teen parents, even when income is factored out. And the evidence suggests that on average, children who live with their biological mother and father do better than those who live in stepfamilies or with cohabiting partners. In light of these facts, policies that strengthen marriage for those who choose it and that discourage unintended birth outside of marriage are sensible goals to pursue. This author goes on to say, preliminary research shows that marriage education workshops can make a real difference in helping married couples stay together and encouraging unmarried couples who are living together to form a lasting bond. Expanding access to such services to low-income couples, perhaps in concert with job training and placement, medical coverage, and other services already available, should be something everybody can agree on. Barack Obama, from his book, The Audacity of Hope. We have come a long way in the United States from the early 1990s, and the idea that fathers were superfluous and marriage didn't matter. I'm going to end with a scene from my favorite movie, The Princess Bride. See that book, that movie? You remember there was a character in that movie called Inigo Montoya. And Inigo Montoya had seen his father killed in a sword fight by a six-fingered man. So he spent his childhood and adolescence honing his swordsmanship skills. And he went in search for the six-fingered man. And you remember at the end of the movie, he finds the six-fingered man, and he says, in words, he's clearly rehearsed his entire life. He's got him in a fight, he's got him by sword point, and he says, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. At which point, Inigo Montoya the six-fingered man starts to beg for his life. And Inigo Montoya says, promise me money. And the guy says, yes, I'm the wealthiest person in the kingdom. All my wealth is yours, but my life. He says, offer me power. He says, I'm the most powerful person in the kingdom. All my power is yours, spare my life. And he says, offer me anything I want. And he says, yes, anything you want is yours. Just ask. And Inigo Montoya says, I want my father back. I think that is the plea, hopefully no longer silent, that our children are giving us. They don't want money. They don't want power. They want their fathers back. It seems to me that government has a role to play in achieving that end for the sake of our kids. Thank you very much.